Okay, well, it's a great pleasure and honour to have a chance to talk to Bob Rowthorne, who I've known for many years. Bob, where and when were you born?
I was born on the 20th of August 1939 in Newport, Monmouthshire, as it was then, in South Wales.
Fine. Tell me something about your family background. You can go back as far as you like, you can go back to 1066 if you want, but most people go back to their grandparents or parents and.
Well, my parents really, I hardly knew my grandparents because they mostly died by the time I was born. So I really have no, almost no memories at all of my grandparents. But my father was a policeman and my mother was a housewife, was occasionally a hairdresser as well. They were both very strong members of the Conservative Party. My father became the mayor eventually, even though it was a Labour town. They were what you might call One Nation Tories, very strong sense of public responsibility, somewhat collectivist in mentality. So I suppose I got that from them really. I also got a very strong sense of justice from them, because they were very concerned with justice, especially my father as a policeman. And I was brought up in through the grammar school system and the Boy Scouts. I would say those are the two biggest influences on me in my youth. Both of which were very, very disciplined. Both of them had corporal punishment. Even the scouts had corporal punishment.
Really? What happened? What could you do as a sort of hit you on the hand, I hope it wasn't sort
On
of.
the bottom with the rope's
Really?
end. It hurt quite a lot, but the point was, if you were in it a few years, you ended up doing it to other people as well as having it done to yourself.
Well, that was
I
the
suppose
job.
nowadays people view the whole thing with horror, but then we just accepted it really. So I suppose that gave me a somewhat robust view of law and order, which I've kept to this day, really.
Going back to your parents, tell me a little more about their personalities. What was your mother and your father like as people, apart from being members of the Conservative Party? I mean, were they gentle or firm or encouraging of your
My
intellectual
father, even
interests?
though he was a police chief, oddly enough, he was rather a gentleman. My mother was probably a little less gentle and certainly somewhat more determined she appeared than my father, but I assume he must have been fairly determined. Other influences on me.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
As I have a brother who eventually became an Anglican bishop in the United States, an Episcopalian bishop, where he now lives having married an
Younger?
American,
Younger?
older brother. And I suppose that, as usual, the youngest son, I rebelled against my brother to some degree.
Yes. Were they encouraging of you intellectually? I mean, did they read? Were they readers or?
They were readers, but they were not terribly well educated. My father was going to go to university, but he was not able to go because his father couldn't afford it, so he never went to university. But it was always assumed at school that I would go to Oxford or Cambridge. Just taken for granted.
Really? It's an unusual school. We'll
Well,
hear about it later, but.
we always used to get a lot of people going to Oxford or Cambridge from the school. It was a local grammar school. And being a steel town, the intake to the school had a lot of working class children in it, or boys, because it was a boys' school.
This is Newport.
Newport, yes.
Newport Grammar School.
Yes, Newport High School for boys.
Let's go back to your preparatory school. Do you remember anything much about that?
That was a private preparatory school. I don't really remember much about it at all, other than the fact it was called Rougemont. But that's just about all I can remember of any significance. I can remember the colour of the clothes. I think grey clothes with a red hat. That's about all I can remember, really.
And I mean, at that age, i.e., between sort of 5 and 10 or whatever, were you an outdoor sort of person or
Yes, I was never a big reader. I wasn't a big reader at school, so I was very interested in mathematics, so I did mathematics, but I didn't do much reading. I was too much outdoors. My mother thought it was bad for me to do too much reading. It's bad for the brain.
A lot of mothers don't think that. Turn off your lights early on, they can't do it. Well, it's obvious that the grammar school, as you said, was very important. You went there at 12 or?
No, younger. I think I
No.
was probably just 11 when I went to grammar school.
You had to get an 11 plus, did you?
Yes, I did, yes. I think that's why my parents sent me to a private preparatory school for a couple of years. I know the 1944 Education Act had tests of a kind that no preparation was supposed to be any use for, but nobody believed it.
Tell me a bit more then about the grammar school. Were there any teachers there who you remember or particularly influenced you?
Yes, there were several teachers, one of whom was quite amusing. But yes, with a philosophy teacher whose name I really don't remember now, but he always used to encourage me to talk about philosophy and join the school debating society. And in fact, I became a socialist when I was at school in the debating society, because there was a boy called Springfield in it, whose father had lost a leg in the Spanish Civil War. I assumed he was a communist or left-wing socialist. And one day during the discussion, he said to me, how could I say that as a socialist? And of course, I'd always thought of myself as a conservative, coming from a conservative background. And I realised that I came from a very collectivist background. Because there's a strand of conservatism, which of course is not free market conservatism at all, but it's very collectivist. And I suddenly realised that, well, maybe I am a socialist after all.
So what age were you then?
16 or 17, probably 17. And having been told I was a socialist, I became one. So when I went to college, I thought of myself as a socialist. But I wasn't aware at that stage of any major change in my views, other than the fact I'd now given myself a different label.
Whether you mentioned mathematics, was that what were you most interested in at school?
Mathematics, I don't know quite why, but I'd always been interested in mathematics. I was not a big reader, and probably I was not a big reader of novels and books in general until my 20s. I was more mathematics. I wasn't even that keen on science. I quite liked science. I found biology incomprehensible. I liked mathematics, basically.
You were good at it?
I was very good at it, yes. And we didn't really have... there were two of us did what I think then was double mathematics, and scholarship level mathematics. And we didn't have a teacher who would teach us, so he just... So the person in charge of mathematics gave us books, and we, two of us, used to study in the stockroom. So I developed my self-education talents there, as it were, because we had very little teaching for mathematics.
And you've got a two A's at advanced maths or whatever.
Yes.
That's interesting. What other hobbies did you have at that stage? I mean, were you interested in sports or games or?
I was quite keen on sports, but I was never that good at them. And I was one of these enthusiastic triers, more athletics, I guess. And certain degree swimming, but mainly athletics. But I was much more interested in camping and walking. Activities like that, which I got from the Scouts.
Yes, this is presumably the main time of the Scouts' influence on you, is it?
Yes, it is. Well, I left the Scouts when I was 15. I don't know quite why, I just probably outgrew it, really.
Why was it so important, do you think?
Well, it's like being in a Cambridge or Oxford college. It's a very strong community. And it's also the Scouts in those days were, I think, probably better than today, because they were very disciplined, somewhat military in style. But the point is, you could rise up through the ranks very quickly. So if you stayed in the Scouts up to the age of 15, you'd become at least the number two in a patrol, and possibly a patrol leader, or in my case, a troop leader. So you very quickly get positions of responsibility. And in those days, you were given enormous responsibilities. I think at the age of maybe just 14 or 13 and three quarters or something of this kind, I was in charge of a patrol of seven camping alongside a tidal river with nobody else there at all. The scoutmaster came to see us, how we were getting on. You're getting on okay, yes, fine.
You mean you were there for several nights and he would just come once or something?
He'd just come once to see how we were getting on, and I just was in charge of them.
Gosh.
And so we ran ourselves, and it seems to me that's that was a great thing for a child that age to do, because of course you respond to the responsibilities.
What about things like music? Were you interested in...
I wasn't very interested in music, and it's one of my great regrets, really. I'm not sure I'm very musical, but one never knows, because my parents certainly didn't make any effort whatsoever to introduce me to any form of music.
Has it been something you've enjoyed since?
To a degree, but looking back at my childhood, the great music thing I remember are hymns. Because being a Welsh school, of course, we used to sing hymns in parts. I mean, really, every morning in assembly they were very good, and that's my main musical memory really.
So you sing?
Yeah,
or you did sing?
To a degree, yes.
Yes. But now do you listen to music?
Not that much.
You go to the carol services and things like that?
Yeah, things like that.
Yeah. Do you think that being that kind of school influenced your brother to be become a bishop later on?
Yes, but that was the 50s he became one, when there was a big move. There was a very strong religious revival in the 50s, of which he was a part.
Do you have arguments with your brother about religion, or have you?
No, not at all. No. I get on fine with my brother. He's in America, which makes things
But perhaps it's a moment to ask you about religion. I mean, has it been important in your life, or?
Not really. I'm a kind of very loose believer in a thing, since I think there's something in it, as indeed in other religions, probably as well as Christianity. But I'm not a very strong religious person.
You never have been. You didn't go through a kind of crisis of faith in your late teens, or anything.
No. I go to church, but I wouldn't describe myself as the strongest believer. But I'm not a non-believer, if you see.
Slightly stronger than an agnostic.
Slightly.
And an Anglican.
Yes, but that's probably background, because I mean, my upbringing, church, family, nation. Duty, there was a whole set of concepts that were all regarded as virtually identical, or they couldn't be separated.
There was an expression of all the other things as well, yeah. So, were there any other things about your school days that are worth recording? I mean, you knew nothing about economics at that time and had no interest in it.
No, I didn't. I think probably something about my school days, I was always a slight outsider in the school. I was strongly a member of it, but never really in the core of it. And I think that may be true about my relationship to institutions in general. That I can't exist without them. I have loyalties to them, but I'm not some... Oddly enough, I'm not a leader. I tend not to play a leading role in institutions unless I have to. Then I can do the job. But actually, there were two incidents I can remember at school. I remember in my school, prefects could give corporal punishment, which is essentially a gym slip. Hit people on, boys on the bottom, you had to bend over, which wasn't that painful, but it's slightly. And I stopped doing that after about a week and ran the chess club instead.
The chess club?
Yes.
As punishment or as a...
No. I devoted my
energies.
My energies to running the chess club instead. That's,
Was this a point of principle, or you just
found... I just found I couldn't do it, really, because some boy refused. And when somebody refused, well, I thought, well, there we go.
That's interesting. I mean, the other thing which we'll perhaps come back on... back to, or maybe we'll pick up now. You mentioned that you suddenly discovered you were a socialist, or in disguise. Politics has always been important through your life, hasn't it?
Yes, I think politics probably runs in families. It doesn't follow that people necessarily have the same political views as their parents or relatives, but I think that some families are much more political than ours. I mean, that's just a casual observation.
And yours was?
Oh yes, highly political.
And you obviously didn't react against it. I thought you were going to say that your parents may have been conservatives, you became socialist, but it wasn't like that.
No, it wasn't actually. I kind of drifted out of it. I mean, I would say nowadays, I think I agree with Mark Twain, I believe, who said his father became more and more intelligent every year.
Interesting. So you drifted back towards an appreciation of your father's politics.
I think probably quite a lot. I think in practice they were not actually anything like as different as I thought.
Did you used to discuss or argue about politics with your parents?
No, never.
No. And did you join any political clubs or anything when you were at school?
Not really, no. We didn't have political clubs as such. We
had just
a debating society, and we had a school, a discussion group. We didn't have political clubs at school. That was only when I went to university.
So this is an unusual school, as I say, expecting you to go to Oxford or Cambridge. And which did you go to?
I applied to Cambridge, but I got admitted to Oxford. I applied to my brother's college, because he came to Christ's Cambridge. But in the end, I went to Jesus College, Oxford, on a scholarship.
Hmm.
To do mathematics, of course.
To do mathematics. And how was your undergraduate degree? Did you enjoy it?
Yes, but when I arrived, my supervisor, or tutor, as he was called in Oxford, said, I think you shouldn't bother going to lectures. Just read the things I'll give you and come and see me once a week if you have any problems.
Who was this?
Thompson, his name was, in Jesus College, Oxford.
Do you remember his first name?
I don't actually know. I'm not sure I would have even known his first name without looking at that. Sound.
Yep, Mr. Thompson. So, was this good advice or not?
It was good advice, but I don't know since I never went to... Well, what it has is it has left me, I'm afraid, that together in my school training with an inability to listen to lectures.
Mm.
I feel myself shuffling after about 10 minutes.
Mm.
Some people seem to be able to manage their own time, but I find it very hard. However good they are, it's not a reflection on the quality of the lecture. And I'm really used to learning by reading.
What effect does it have on your giving of lectures if you're aware that you would be shuffling after 10 minutes?
Well, oddly enough, my lectures used to be very highly rated.
Mm.
But they were always regarded as interesting, but not necessarily brilliantly organised.
Mm.
But successful, pretty highly rated.
Mm. So you enjoyed giving them, but not listening to them?
Yes, that's right.
And you did enjoy that?
Some people say that's the story of my life.
A good talker, and not so good at listening. You did enjoy giving lectures?
Yes, as long as I had prepared for them properly.
Mm.
Or else not prepared at all. If somebody would ask me to say, could you talk for half an hour on a subject, and I'd say I haven't prepared at all,
mm.
and the whole audience knew I hadn't prepared, that's no problem, because there's no expect. If you make a mistake in that situation, people forgive you. It's when you're supposed to be prepared and you're not, I think, is the problem.
Mm.
But that must be true of everybody.
Mm. Well, not everyone. Some people dry up with no preparation. Did you read economics all the way through, or PPE, or what?
No, I did mathematics at university.
Oh, mathematics, of course.
Yes,
yeah.
I did.
Yeah.
I did straight maths all the way through.
Yeah. And you did all right?
I did very well, yes.
You got a first?
Yes. I got a first. That's my highest achievement in me, probably. No, I did very well at maths, and then...
You got a prize, did you say?
I did, yes. It's called a junior mathematical prize for the best degree.
Hmm.
But, yes, I did very well. And the other things I did as well, I suppose my main other activity when I was a student, or two other activities, was rowing. I was in the first aid. I was very keen on rowing.
First aid of your college,
yes,
Jesus.
Yeah. That wasn't very good, because we went down... almost every time we ever went out, but never mind. And the other thing, I went to political clubs a lot.
Mm.
I went to the Labour Club, but I went to other ones as well. Those are my main interests, I suppose, in mountaineering.
Mountaineering?
Yes, outdoor pursuits.
Mm.
But I realised I gave up mountaineering in the end, because I realised I got frightened too much.
Mm.
Especially when people started falling off and getting killed, people I knew, so...
You gave it up. That was after university or at university?
At university.
Mm. What were the political clubs you joined? Socialist Party?
Labour Club. I went, I think, Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. I went on various Aldermaston marches.
Hmm.
You know, I think even in those days I was in favour of nuclear power, so that put me in a small minority of people who seem to think if you're against nuclear weapons, you're against nuclear power as well.
Hmm. Did you have any particular lecturers or teachers who, at that time, had a big influence on you?
Well, the only one was
Thompson.
Thompson. I never met anyone else. I did have a specialist called Higman. I think he's just died now.
Higman?
Higman, yes. Mm. Who was my third year.
Mm.
And then, I think my undergraduate days in Oxford were probably not so important.
Mm.
Because then I got a research fellowship in... Well, it was a postgraduate fellowship in Berkeley, California, University of California, Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there to do mathematics, which was not really very successful. And I thought a lot about why it wasn't successful. So then eventually I switched to economics. And I think the reason it wasn't is that when I did mathematics, I really learned how to solve problems in books. And if you read a textbook, you know, there's an answer to the questions they set you, as they give a question, and the question is always on the basis of what you've already learned. So you already know what the question is, and you use known techniques to solve it. So I became very good at solving problems, which I could still do pretty well. But what you don't learn is really what the philosophical basis of mathematics is and why people do mathematics. And you don't really learn, therefore, how to ask interesting questions of it yourself. And I think when I went to California, I went on a special program called Logic and the Methodology of Science, which is in fact involves philosophy as well as mathematics. And I find it very hard to think my way through the various forms of mathematical logic and so on, because I didn't understand what the purpose of it was. I mean, if I went back now with the brain I had at 21, as it were, I'd probably be very good, because I now understand why people were asking these questions. But at the time, I couldn't understand why they were asking certain kinds of questions, which were much more open-ended than the kind of thing I'd done as an undergraduate. So I rather lost my way in Berkeley. And I came back to England and eventually switched to math.
How long were you there?
For 1 year.
Did you like America?
Yes, well, it was a very interesting period, because that's in a sense when I got attached to, in a serious way, to the left, because now I realise the left in Berkeley was the so-called the old left. It was actually run by communists, but I didn't know this. It's just what the conservatives were saying in America, that it was a communist conspiracy. But the conservatives didn't realise, but the communists were the moderates. And as they began to lose their hold, Berkeley became more and more radical. But anyway, I really, that was the time when I became more firmly politicised, I would say, in Berkeley. And I also met somebody there who eventually convinced me to do economics, who is somebody called Brian Van Arkady.
How do you spell the name?
B-A-N-A-R-K-A-D-I-E. I think they come from a group of, historically, from a group of Dutch settlers in Sri Lanka. He eventually got a job in Cambridge and still has a house here, but he lives half the time elsewhere. So I shared a house with him, and he introduced me to economics.
So after a year you came back here, and then what did you do?
I carried on doing mathematics for a year, but I was getting nowhere. So
You had a doctoral?
In fact, actually, it wasn't a year. It must have been less. It must have been much less than a year. I can't remember now. I can't remember whether it was a year or 18 months, but anyway. The point was, eventually I lost any funding, and I switched to economics with no money. But I did very well in economics, so I got money, I got a scholarship, which was backdated, so I was able to pay back the money to all my friends who supported me. Then I did economics for a couple of years.
Was this a PhD? Or?
No, it's a postgraduate degree called a BPhil, and it's essentially a master's degree.
Yeah.
And it's common for people to switch over.
And where did you come back to?
I came back to Oxford, my own college, College. And then I went to Nuffield for a bit. Nuffield College, Oxford. And then I got a job in Cambridge as an economist in Churchill.
Churchill. So you got a job in Churchill without a PhD or anything, those
well,
of the days.
People didn't have PhDs then.
No.
Nobody ever suggested me I should be a PhD.
And you came to Churchill as a teacher, the teacher.
I think I did. I must have been Title A Fellow, which I think is a teaching fellow. Yes. That's right. And then I was poached by Richard Kahn, Lord Kahn, to come to King's.
After how long?
After
that?
1 year, I think. I think it's 1 year. I'm sorry to be so very...
No, don't worry. It's a virtual history. You mentioned Richard Kahn. He's been mentioned by others. What sort of man was he, and what influence was he on you, if any?
Intellectually, he had, I would say, very little influence. I mean, he was very famous because he contributed to the ideas underlying Keynes's general theory. He invented the so-called multiplier, which really says that if somebody spends some more money, it'll generate extra demand, because the people who get the money will spend some of the money, and they will spend, then the people who get that money will spend some, and so on. And the question is, how much? If I spend £1, how much extra demand does it generate? And the answer is, if it's £3 altogether, then the multiplier is 3. £1 generates a total of three, so that's the multiplier. He worked all that out.
Mm.
And I think that was his really big
contribution. Was he a great economist, do you think?
I think he was, yes. He was, the thing about the Keynes School, or sort of Keynes in economics, was it was a collective enterprise, really. There were a lot of people involved in it, and he was an important figure.
And the others were... I mean, I know, possibly, but it's nice.
I'm just trying to say there's a very large number of them. Well, I mean, the history of the Keynesian school is a difficult one because it's so partisan, the histories of it.
Mm.
And I think the greatest economist of the Keynesian school was actually D.H. Robertson, who was rejected by the Keynesians and regarded as anti-Keynesian.
Mm.
But in my opinion, he invented most of it.
Mm.
This is not an opinion that makes me necessarily popular with him.
Greater than Keynes himself, or?
I think probably yes. It's difficult to say. I think D.H. Robertson wrote a book called Banking Policy and the Price Level, which I think foreshadows almost all the ideas in the Keynesian system.
He wrote it before Keynes? Or?
Yes, he did. Well, not before Keynes, because Keynes lived a long time, but he wrote it well before Keynes' general theory.
Mm.
He wrote it in a very idiosyncratic language, so it's quite hard to follow.
Mm.
I was once in a reading group, and we learnt the language, so we would speak to each other in what was a form of a code, as it were, or slang, which is the language.
So he was perhaps the greatest, along with Kent, and then who were the others? Joan Robinson was one?
Difficult to say.
Strapper?
I think the greatest one, the other great one, was not a Keynes, was Kalecki.
Hmm.
Michał Kalecki, who was in Oxford. He was Polish, and he was a Polish refugee in Oxford. I think he was the third great one.
And what was his contribution?
Well, his contribution was that he formalised it into very good mathematical models and put it in a more coherent framework. And also I think he had a variety of particular ideas of his own, but I'm not sure how much I can explain them in an interview.
Yes, you can explain as much as you like. Okay. Bits of technical stuff are very nice in an interview. So.
Oh, I see. Well, in Keynes' general theory, if there's an increase in demand in Keynes' general theory, if people decide to spend more, for example, or the government injects money into the economy, it will only increase the output in the economy and increase the level of employment if it leads to higher prices. And what the higher prices do is they reduce the real wage of workers. So essentially, in what happens is, say, the government spends money, this pushes up the price level, reduces the real wages, money wages stay the same, so the prices become higher and firms produce more because it's now more profitable. So inflation, if you like, or at least higher prices and lower wages in real terms are the essential aspect of, an essential part of increasing the level of output in an economy. So essentially what Keynes's demand arguments are is the government spends more or somebody else spends more, this pushes up prices, this reduces the standard of living of workers who have currently got jobs, but it encourages firms to employ more people. So in other words, the existing workforce loses, but new people gain because of this extra employment. And that's a central part of the structure of the general theory. Now, what Kalecki did, he has a different model altogether. He has the so-called monopolistic pricing model, in which what happens is that if the government spends money, the firms will increase output without increasing their prices, so long as they've got excess capacity in the economy. So if every firm is, say, operating at 80% capacity and the government spends money, what happens in Kalecki is that quite simply output rises, employment rises, and the existing workers don't lose anything. They don't lose anything at all. So there's no trade-off, if you like, between higher prices and employment, whereas there is in Keynes' general theory.
So in effect, the government is employing these firms to produce more?
It could be just that I decide to save less money. Mm. I decide to save less and spend more of my money, and that generates extra demand.
Yeah.
and that means there's more employment. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, that's obviously not true if every firm is operating at full capacity because they can't produce anymore. So that's quite an important difference, because it means that the government can manipulate the level of demand up to a point without causing inflation. And Joan Robinson promoted Kalecki very strongly, and I think she was quite right to do so. And in fact, one of the big changes in the Keynesian economics that came after Keynes's general theory was the shift towards Kalecki's way of thinking about it. Because in Keynes, it was a simple trade-off. If you want to get more employment, you have to raise prices and you have to reduce real wages. That's not true in later followers of Keynes. And the intellectual basis was really laid out partly by Kalecki, but also earlier by Joan Robinson in her stuff on monopoly pricing. And that, I think, was her great contribution, was much earlier, not all the later stuff she did.
Hmm. Did you know her?
I did, yes. Hmm. Yes, I did.
Quite a tough lady, as I remember.
Yes, well, my view of the Keynesians in general was that when, by the time I got to know them, they were really on very much on the defensive.
Hmm.
And they were the British Keynesians. Hmm. And they were on the defensive for two reasons. I think they were probably to the left of most of the Keynesians, most to the left of American Keynesians. But the other thing is that Britain was losing influence and Cambridge was losing influence. So they were basically fighting a battle. They really thought of themselves as being the heirs of Keynes. They held the power to determine how Keynes should be interpreted. And they thought of themselves, I think, as being natural leaders, as it were. And I think they found it very hard to adapt to the fact they were facing an intellectually more competitive environment. And of course they were facing challenges that were not so sympathetic to their way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the case of Joan Robinson, she particularly reacted in a very authoritarian way and over-politicised debates. So the debates which would be the technical variety became converted into political debates. And so my memory of it was that it was a great, very dogmatic response to the outside world, including me.
Hmm.
I mean, I can never, I don't think I will forget a debate I had with her. Well, it wasn't a debate, an argument I had in a tea room or a common room, in which, being an innocent, I'd only arrived in Cambridge a few months before, I had gone to read a book by the economist Hicks, Sir John Hicks.
Hmm. Yeah. Mutual Free
Market. Yes, but yes, but this was an article called Mr. Keynes and the Classics.
Mm.
And what he wanted to do was provide a neat little summary of how Keynes's general theory tied in with the classical economists. That would be Ricardo, for example. And it's and I suppose Marshall. And it's a very neat little article. And I read it, having just read the general theory, and I knew nothing about any of the debates. I was completely innocent. I mean, I'd read the general theory, and I read this, and I thought, oh, this looks quite good. So I said to Joan Robinson, just casually in a cup of tea, while we were having a cup of tea, I've just read a really good article on Keynes' general theory called Mr. Keynes and the Classics.
Wow.
Well, I must say, she erupted. Mm. Oh, that's absolutely outrageous, you know, terrible article, complete distortion. I says, well, it doesn't seem to be a distortion to me. He says the following. She says, Keynes never said that. I said, well, he did. I read it last week. She said, no, he didn't. I said, yes, he did. I mean, I wouldn't back down for anyone. And so she said, well, he shouldn't have said it. So I said, well, yes. And I said, you can hardly criticise Hicks for reporting accurately what Keynes said. Just because you don't agree with it.
Mm.
And that was typical of it, of her. She knew what the true Keynes was. Mm. And this wasn't really Keynes, it's just what he said.
Mm.
And the true Keynes is what she thought he ought to have said.
Mm.
And maybe, who knows, he did it at other times. But anyway, that was the beginning of a pretty bad relationship with John. But I think an aspect of this period, this is a very rich vein, it must be said, an aspect of this period was the ostrich-like approach of the Keynesians here, the left Keynesians, with one exception, and the exception would be Caldor. Because what they wanted to do, they saw the enemy as the people they called, the quotes, the neoclassical economists, which I would say would tend to be the dominant Keynesians nowadays, would still be neoclassical economists. They'd be American Keynesians like Robert Sawyer and others. And they really wanted to discredit them. So they turned to the work of Piero Sraffa to do it. Now I think, and what happened with Piero Sraffa is a whole generation of research students, younger faculty members in various places, including an extremely large number of Italians, turned to the work of Piero Sraffa.
Passanese. Was he one of them? Luigi?
Yes, not quite so much, but a bit younger than this. Yeah. I mean, he ploughed his own furrow, really, Luigi Passanese. I wouldn't put him in the same camp at all. He was closer to Caldwell. Anyway, they did the work of Piero Sraffa. They wrote endless articles about Piero Sraffa, about re-switching of techniques and things like this, and I'm sure one of your interviewees may have talked about this more sympathetically. And I'm afraid I just thought this stuff, I mastered it, being a mathematician it wasn't very difficult, but I thought it was a complete sidetrack of no real significance at all, apart from about 3 months when I believed it, fit with enthusiasm. So I wrote an article very critical of it in the New Left Review, and in a sense that marked a break between me and that school of thought, I would say. I became much more of a classical Marxist, but I felt I did, and I thought Marx had the answer to almost everything then. But if I was to look at the Cambridge economists as a whole of this variety, there were two strands to the Keynesians. There was the Robinson strand, which was Robinson, Sraffa, and others, I think. And then there would be Caldor and to some extent Passanetti in it. Now I think Caldor was a brilliant economist. He wasn't in the school at all. He wasn't defensive in this kind of way. He was too interested in creating new ideas. And I think the fact that he died relatively young was a great loss. And I think Keynesian economics would have been very different if he'd lived another 10 years. A tremendous loss, I think.
And what was he like as a person? Quite a large, overwhelming.
Well, he was larger than life, as it were. He was as a person as he seemed. He was very large from eating a very large amount, and was very jolly and full of life. I mean, I think he was a wonderful man. I mean, he had his defects, but I mean, don't we all? But intellectually, he was like that. I mean, he wasn't terribly disciplined intellectually. He didn't have time for the details, but he was very, very creative. And the great thing I think he had, which differentiated him from many of the of another school of Keynesians, he thought capitalism is intrinsically a dynamic system, unstable but dynamic. He was a bit Schumpeterian like this. He never thought of capitalism as a stagnant and stationary system that required the government to give it a boot to get it moving all the time. Because what came out of the Keynesian tradition was a string of Keynesians who thought that capitalism naturally tends towards stagnation. I mean, someone like Paul Sweezy, the Marxist, but Keynesian influence, was in the school of thought. And I think I wouldn't put Caldor in that. Caldor thought the system was too disorderly to be simply stagnant, and I think he was right.
You mentioned Sweezy as a Marxist, and it's not really what Marx thought, that it would lead to stagnation, as you say, but you also mentioned yourself as someone who is a Marxist economist. When did you read Marx deeply, or did he influence you? At what stage?
He did. I'm trying to think when he did. I think probably in the later 60s. We had, of course, as everyone did then, we had a Capital reading group, and we read Marx's Capital at great length. I mean, I still think Marx. I mean, Marx's biggest mistake was to believe there's an alternative to capitalism. Well, he's put it, that's too general a statement, because there are different forms of capitalism, there are different roles for the state. But I think his biggest mistake was to overemphasize the role of human rationality, what human beings can consciously understand, that somehow we would be able to plan highly complex world economy in a coherent and rational way, knowing everything about it. No, I think this is a pure fantasy. I mean, I think that, as the Bible says, we see through a glass darkly. In other words, we have individuals are very, very limited. And what they can do, even what they can understand as a collectivity so they can all perceive it, is very limited. I mean, you can add together their own individual bits of knowledge. The market aggregates these pieces of individual knowledge to produce a coherent outcome. And you can accumulate wisdom from the past and books and things like this. But I think what can be known is always very limited in nature. And I think the notion you can plan the totality of the world economy, I think, is absolute rubbish. And I think that was Marx's biggest mistake. On the other hand, his analysis of capitalism in many ways is absolutely brilliant, I think. And in fact lives on today, but of course unrecognised, because if an idea is really good, even your enemies will eventually take it up, which is what's actually happened. I mean, quite a lot of things in modern economics, whether you can trace them back to Marx or not is difficult to say, because every historian of thought will tell you that no one ever has an original idea. They can always find somebody else who perceives them. But I think Marx has had a great influence. And I got very interested in Marx in the late 60s. And I gave lectures on Marx for many years.
Do you think his over-optimism about human rationality was the way in which we can see through that now is made easier for us after the experience of the Soviet Union and other experiments in trying to carry out his prescriptions?
Yes, I do. I think there are great events in history which helped promote Marxist ideas, and others which did the opposite. The First World War, I think, was a very central thing for leading to widespread belief in the possibilities of central planning, because of what's called war socialism. That in wartime, the objectives of the society are relatively limited, and large amounts of desires that people have are pushed aside. And things are focused on a rather limited number of objectives, like more weapons, more this, that and the other. And these are things which the state can often do quite effectively. And I think the First World War demonstrated, especially in Britain, the power of the state, if it really put its mind to things, what it can actually achieve. And I think that gave quite a boost to the ideas of socialism, or planning. Central planning, and I think the 20s in Russia did that, but that's too considerably, because people didn't actually know what was happening. Well, if they did know, they chose not to see. If they were presented with the evidence, they chose not to see it. Now when we look back at the 20s and 30s in Russia, for example, we can actually see the enormous cost there was in Soviet planning. I mean, it's true, they did have some great achievements as well, but at phenomenal cost. But they were rather limited objectives, not in the sense they were grand projects, but they were limited number of things they had to do. There didn't have to be such a huge diversity of different products. And I think that communism, in the sense of central planning, has worked best when it's focused on a rather small number of objectives, which take priority over others. And it doesn't mean it doesn't very efficiently, because there's often enormous waste in it. It's just the waste takes the form of human suffering, which is not expressed very much. But it's a history of great achievement, but it's a great achievement in the sense that empires have always been great achievements, often a great human cost. They've done wonderful things, but at the same time with huge costs. And I think that it's not very viable for peacetime. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that I think that it wasn't just the failures of communism. I think the failures of planning occurred when the planned societies moved towards the technological frontier. They were fine, basically, as long as they were well behind and they were catching up, because they could identify what the goal was. As it were, planning is good for achieving a well-defined goal with well-defined means, but it's not so good at finding where to go when you've reached this goal.
So Japan would be a very good example of that. MITI and so on, when they were trying to catch up with America, was fine, but now they don't know.
Well, that's true, but that's true of the East Asians in general. Mm. It's true of Korea, it's true of Taiwan.
Mm.
So I think There's been an unduly negative attitude towards planning. I think, for example, Africa today, as long as you could get honest governments, would do with a bit more, could do with a bit more of it.
Mm.
It's just, but that's different from, one of the interesting things is that quite a lot of people who became the architects, I understand this, and I'm told this by colleagues, Harjun Chang, for example, who knows about these things in my faculty, he said that a fair number of people who've been involved in planning various things like East Asian miracles, Taiwan, Korea and so on, are ex-Marxists. And they took over their belief, and Lee Kuan Yew was an example, so they took over their belief in the role of the state, but they believed a much more limited role for it. And it turns out that central planning, or as a coherent state activity, works best in an economy which has got quite an extensive market. Because then the tasks of the state are much more limited and they can achieve them effectively. But paradoxically, communist regimes fail because they try to do everything. And as it were, doing a limited number of things well is much better than trying to do everything. And so I would say that paradoxically Marx laid some of the basis for a reformed capitalism.
What about the case of China? Because here you have a very big market. A state which does quite try and do quite a lot and has, at the moment anyway, appears to be being very successful. Do you think it will suffer the same difficulty, lose its direction?
Well, I think the first thing is that it has an extensive market economy in China. I think that's been true always. I don't think, apart from the most certain extreme episodes, I think the market has never been suppressed to quite the same degree in China as elsewhere. But the thing is that there's an extensive market economy now. This is one of the reasons why there's so much inequality in the system. But the Chinese state preserves great capacity. I mean, in this recent earthquake, they acted very, very effectively. And they really did. I mean, I think that there's some negative things in China, like Tibet, for example, but I think that it's an extraordinary achievement what they're doing now. And I think in the end, the problems there will be more political and economic, which is how to make a transition to some functioning democracy, which I think is hard. But it's not impossible. Like Taiwan did it, for example, which is a very deeply internally divided society, I mean, much more so than China is. So in the sense that there are the ethnic Taiwanese and then the Chinese from the mainland, and they seem to have done it. So maybe the Chinese will.
Have you spent much of your professional life in places outside Europe?
Yes, but oddly enough, I've never been to China or India.
You haven't?
I never went to China because I was in the Communist Party and we were deeply suspicious of Maoist attacks on China. And since then, I haven't gone, I think, partly because for a long time I had this deep suspicion when it was the old style China that we'd be showed what they'd show us what we wanted to see. And I'd never been to Cuba for the same reason.
I mean, this hasn't been true for 15 years or so.
I know it hasn't, but no, other things. Things have taken in other directions since then.
And you haven't been to India because you haven't been to India.
That's right, exactly.
What about Japan?
Yeah, I've been to Japan a few times. I like Japan. I mean, for me, Japan's the most foreign. I've been to Africa and Latin America and so on, but for me, Japan's the most foreign country I've ever been to, by quite a long way. I think the kind of internalised discipline of the Japanese, which I admire, is something which I've never seen anywhere else.
How long have you spent there?
I've been there about 5 times, I think. I've stayed with Japanese friends, so I haven't stayed in hotels. Altogether, only about 6 or 7 weeks if you add them together.
And have you been back to America much?
Yes, I go to America a lot because I'm in a research project in Santa Fe.
Oh, you're with the MIT?
No, research project at the Santa Fe Institute.
Oh, right.
My interests have shifted radically, although oddly enough, they still. The people I work with, I suppose, would all be ex-Marxists.
Do you count yourself as an ex-Marxist?
Yes, I mean, since they would be to the left of me, most of these people. I don't regard myself as left-wing now. I mean, I would regard myself I think I regard myself more as a community. I use the word communitarian about myself, I think. I basically think people have to look after each other. But I'm not really sure what I believe about the structures that can achieve this. And I also don't, I no longer have the confidence of some grand scheme which would vast numbers of people would be killed in order to achieve it.
You did once have such a confidence, didn't you?
Probably not, no. Not to that degree.
Do you enjoy going to America? What do you think of it in its recent political history, for instance?
Well, I was thinking United States is a strange society. In some ways it's uncivilized, I think, in the sense that there are islands of civilization into it, but it's a very disintegrated society, I think, physically. People live very separate lives because of the motor car, for example. So it's uncivilized in the literal sense, people don't live in what we regard as cities, even though physically they look like them. The latest politics, I think that the deepest problem in the United States, and certainly internationally, is a failure to recognize that American dominance is being undermined very, very quickly. That much of something like Iraq, for example, I don't think that the stuff about the United Nations being, my respect for the United Nations is almost nil. So the fact that in the end it proves there's something or not is, to me, of no great significance in a moral sense, or it may have a political significance. I think that the biggest problem is that I think overweening pride. I think the Bush regime, government, shall I say, administration, has had very little understanding of how fragile America's leadership now, dominance is going to be. It isn't going to last long, not with the rise of China and India, for example, and other great powers like Brazil and possibly Indonesia. There's lots on the horizon. And their whole perspective was that somehow they would remain on top forever. And so I think that the big problem for the United States is to negotiate, if you like, its way over the next few decades so that it still continues to have some influence, but to learn to live with others. Which is not very easy, after all, Britain's faced this problem.
I was going to say, their famous remarks about with no empire and no rule, or whatever the remark is. Same sort of problem, which happened to us very quickly.
It'll happen more slowly to the United States because its population is much bigger and growing. I mean, we'll have half. But even so, I think that would be my greatest criticism. I mean, people say, all right, the war in Iraq cost 700,000 lives. Well, you know, I mean, that's a tragedy in personal terms. But on the grand scale of world politics, that's not very much if you consider the millions and millions killed in the Second World War or in the First World War. I think that it's more that the US behaved in Iraq as if somehow they not only ruled the world, but they continue doing so. So I think that whoever takes over in America, I think it's going to have the biggest problem for them, I think, is going to be able to is to negotiate a relationship with rising powers.
Let's go back to Kings, who came here. What year was it, do you remember?
65, I think.
65.
Yeah.
I've been here 6 years longer than I have.
Well, off and on, you see, because when I was in King's, I left King's after a time because I had an argument with the then Director of Studies, Robin Maris.
Oh, yes.
Who said I was lazy and didn't turn up and do my teaching and I wasn't organised. So I said that there was some truth in this. But it wasn't entirely untrue because the same complaints could be made about him. But so I left college in a certain and under a slight cloud, and then I eventually.
What? When did you leave?
Early 70s, sometime 70s.
I think we overlapped a bit when I was at Yale.
That's right. And so then I carried on in the economics faculty, and then when I got made a professor there, I got offered a professorial fellowship.
So when did you come back?
12 years ago, approximately. Something like that. As you know, because I'm not very good on dates.
Yeah. So you were away quite a long time.
Oh, I was, yeah.
And did you miss the college?
I did. I missed it more as time went by. Really. I used to come in for lunch, because I bought my lunch here, so I was a semi-member of the college for quite a long time, you see. long before, for much longer than I was a fellow.
What do you, I mean, I've asked a lot of people whether they think the collegiate system has been helpful or a hindrance to their research and work and academic achievements in Cambridge. What is your feeling about it?
Very positive for me, because especially the second time round, because I've met a lot of people in the last 15 years. A lot of my work has been done on things related to biology, evolution, things like this. Less than 15 publications, probably about 7 publications, but thinking. And that's really come out of meeting people in Kings, especially at dinner, actually. Robert Foley, for example, Chris Gilligan. Robert Foley's a biological anthropologist, Chris Gilligan's a biologist, Kent biologist. I've worked with them, and that's been straightforward as a result of meeting people. And I'm very interested in philosophical issues, so I have a very good time here, because there are lots of philosophers here to talk to. And indeed, I've talked to you about anthropological issues.
You have indeed. We've corresponded on it. I mean, do you feel that having a kind of fellowship and equality at that level, plus a certain amount of alcohol, has made it easier to leap across disciplinary boundaries?
Oh yes, I think to an enormous degree. Elsewhere people spend a huge amount of effort trying to encourage cross-disciplinary communication, which takes place, I think, effortlessly here. I mean, I think colleges are very good institutions, quite apart from students, who are an important part of them. But I think they're very good things, because they're not the place for careerism. I mean, there are a few college people who always make their careers in college, but the point is that typically whatever subject you work in, there's a very small number of you in the college. So if you communicate with other people in the college, it tends to be on the ground of interest, not on the ground, in the sense you're interested in the ideas, it's not a simple career move. It's less instrumental, I think. That's my experience. Anyway, I mean, I don't really know what others' experiences.
Well, many had said similar things. Meeting at dinner and, you know, getting into a collaboration like Pat and...
Pat's had a big influence on me as well, Pat Bates.
Well, but actually, over the years, who have been among the fellowship, obviously at the beginning some economists, but have become friends and colleagues? Your closest one, Pat, you mentioned, and Chris. And
Pat Bates and Chris Gilligan, Robert Foley, I would guess those would be the three closest. And also Jim Trevithick, because we're both economists and being directors of studies.
Do you find undergraduate teaching, you obviously at the beginning found, at least Robin found, that you weren't doing what you were meant to be doing or thought you would have, but have you found having to supervise undergraduates or PhD students helpful in your work? Or?
Well, meeting undergraduates, their comment was always about me in my early days that I gave brilliant supervisions when I turned up, but that they seem to think I did okay. I mean, postgraduates, yeah, sure. I mean, my main collaborator at the moment is an ex-postgraduate student of mine, PhD student. There's a group of three of us. We're working on evolutionary models. And the third member is his ex-PhD student, so I'm the grandfather, as it were. In fact, the best things I would say I've done intellectually. Two things. I did a course on institutional economics. It's a postgraduate course, a specialist course. So I always worked on the principle I'd do anything I wanted to do. So if I wanted to do some biology, I'd do biology. If I wanted to do something else, I'd do something law and economics, I'd do law and economics that term. But it was always very successful, extremely successful.
And no one tried to stop you?
Oh no, the economics faculty is not like that. I mean, people might kill each other, but intellectually they're quite tolerant. I mean, many people don't like the economics faculty because they think it's been too conflictual historically. But I must say, by and large, I'm quite fond of it. My negative side towards it would be really, I think that when I broke with the Straffians, I became too isolated. I didn't have enough people to collaborate with there. So my work suffered, I think, over the years by not being in a very well-defined intellectual environment. But I still look back at it fondly. But anyway, the one thing was my course in Institute of Economics, which I think was very successful. I'm thinking of reviving it in the coming year, even though I'm no longer a professor at the faculty. Mm. An emeritus professor.
Yes.
But I'm not sure, it might be too big a commitment. The other thing was, together with Carlos Rodriguez, who's the research student I was talking about, we set up a reading group, a philosophical come political reading group come economics reading group. And again, we always read an article once a week, and we serendipitously would always be, as it were, what the previous week suggested, so we'd work. And we went for about 4 years. Of course, there's a slightly changing membership because of postgraduates. So I think we worked our way through many philosophical things, a fair number of things in anthropology, and politics, for example.
Mm.
And I would regard that as the most stimulating period in my life, I would say.
When was this?
It just ended about 3 years ago. Mm. It ended when Carlos Rodriguez... It ended when I retired from the economics faculty, so I gave up my course. And it also... And that was the same time he went back to Chile.
Mm.
So it died a natural death, really. I think it was probably dying in the last year anyway.
Mm.
But as a result of that, I've got very good friends scattered all over the world.
Mm.
And I really got an enormous amount out of that. It's one of the reasons I was thinking of doing the course again was to try and make contact with postgraduate students.
Mm.
But I'm not sure whether, as it were, it might just be not too much of a nostalgic thing to do, really.
You're not supervising any PhDs now. You're finished.
I have, yes.
Yeah. We were just talking about the old left, the new left, the old left, really. Let's start on a calm note with Edward Thompson. What was your contact with Edward?
Well, I got to know Edward Thompson through a friend of mine called Sheila Robotham.
Yep, I know Sheila.
Who's a feminist historian. And he had a big effect on me at a certain time. I think what most affected me about him was his great faith in ordinary people. I mean, he was a great Democrat,
mm-hmm.
and genuinely very, very Democratic.
Mm-hmm.
He was in the Communist Party for a time, like many others, and he left, I think, over 56 in Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very keen on the popular democratic tradition, the belief that democracy is rooted in the behaviour and attitudes of ordinary people. And he was very insistent upon its contribution to English life, because he wasn't so much concerned with Scotland and Wales, to English life, and fought a very strong battle against the people like Perry Anderson, who believed that we had nothing to contribute from this country, and it just would all come from continental Marxism.
Hmm.
I mean, I probably wouldn't be quite as extreme as Edward Thompson was, but he had a big influence in me in this respect.
Did you know him as a person?
Yes, I knew him quite well. I used to stay in his cottage in
Wales.
Wales, yes. Mm. And I think he was a wonderful person. Well, his wife Dorothy was as well, I think.
Mm.
I think she's still alive.
Yeah.
And that had a very big effect on me. And I think if I look back on the left, I think the greatest weakness, this wouldn't be true of Edward Thompson, but looking back on the left, the greatest weakness of the left, I think, has been its failure to take responsibility for historical events. I mean, one thing, if I think an example of this, for example, would be on the other side, something like Eric Osborne, who's written about the left and so on. And
he wrote a book called...
He wrote a book called...
Interesting Times.
Interesting Times, that's right. And what struck me in that is the failure to recognise how much of what's gone wrong in the last 100 years, or in fact the last 200 years, has been provoked by the left. It's not just that the left is defending virtue against the right, but the left itself has been responsible for many things in two senses. First of all, it's done many bad things, and secondly, it's produced in many cases a reaction from people who were desperate to resist them. And then, of course, they went much too far, their opponents went much too far. I think of this with something like the Spanish Civil War. The standard history of the Spanish Civil War is that a democratic reforming government came in 1936 to be resisted by monstrous reactionaries who wanted to preserve the privilege of the old order. And there was a heroic struggle by the Democrats against the forces of reaction. And this laid the basis to the Second World War because the left was defeated. Well, if you read the history prior to the Spanish Civil War, you can realise that, all through the preceding few years, the more lunatic versions of the left, and in fact had quite widespread support, engaged in very provocative attacks on the Catholic Church, upon priests and so on, and behaved very, very brutally. And the great massacre, first great massacre of the Spanish Civil War was conducted by the left, not by the right, in Paracuellas, just outside Madrid. And that symbolises many things in which the left has been responsible for later monstrosities, because the truth is that the Franco government was very brutal. I mean, it's not to say the Franco came in and established a good regime, not at all. But the fact is the left has a heavy responsibility to bear for what happened in Spain. And I think the same with Pinochet in Chile, that the Allende government created a totally unsustainable situation and led once again to a brutal regime. It's not to defend the substitute. And I think the left has repeatedly failed to confront this. I think that kind of left is now dying. I think with the collapse of communism, that kind of utopian left has, I think, taken a real hammering. Because I think this kind of behaviour is a result of a kind of utopianism. That if you can only destabilise the existing system and persecute people from the old order, some wonderful new order will arise out of the ashes. And I think the history shows this is not actually correct. And so I've become, that's one of the reasons I wouldn't regard myself as left-wing anymore. I'd regard myself as left-wing in the sense of saying that there are a lot of poor people in the world who deserve a better deal, and that those of us who are better off maybe should make some sacrifices for it, or society should be better organised so that it doesn't generate this kind of poverty and so on. I certainly think that's right, and I think there are definite injustices in the world. But I'm not left-wing in the sense that I think there's a simple blueprint where you can just simply now produce a clear and simple alternative. I think these things are quite a serious challenge. And I also think attempts to produce this new world based on a grand blueprint have led to disaster.
How would you account for the difficulty that very intelligent people have in accepting that something... I mean, Kirster wrote that book called The God Who Died or something to this. I mean, it seems almost as if early extreme communists, like many other utopianists, feel a religious attachment to their ideas, and it's very difficult for them later on in their lives to eschew it. I mean, one example you mentioned in passing in a way was Eric Hobsbawm's continuing apparent refusal to accept that Stalin's atrocities were quite as bad as had been painted, or that he made any terrible mistakes. How would you account for this resistance?
Well, I think part of it is because people think there are two sides, and if you're not for us, you're against us. And so I think they basically say, well, somebody once said many years ago in the Italian election about conservatives said, about corruption in Italy, he said, vote Christian Democrat and hold your nose. I think it's a similar kind of thing. But I think that the reason that people supported and didn't say things, supported the left and didn't say things about it, was that they thought that they would weaken the left if they said it. It's a bit like being in the Second World War fighting Nazi Germany, and the Britain's fighting for its life, and you found out very bad things that the British government had been doing. You'd face the problem. You'd say, well, look, if we publicise this, it'll weaken us, and maybe we'll lose as a result, and it'll be worse. Yeah. So better shut up, keep my mouth shut. And
you can see how this would occur during the time, but now, I mean, Stalin was a long time ago. Is it going to weaken anything to admit that he was a terrible dictator and did awful things?
Well, I think people would have to... a lot of people find it very hard to confront their past, I think. I mean, I can give an example of it. When the Soviet Union invaded Czechoslovakia, I was in the Communist was in the Communist Party, I think. I'm not sure I was, actually. No, I wasn't in the Communist Party, but I was later. And at the time, I supported it. I supported it because I thought it was a strategic conflict between East and West, and that it was more important to keep the Soviet bloc as a coherent and functioning entity than the democratic rights of the Czech people. I mean, essentially, I did support it, and most other people I know, even in the Communist Party, didn't, but I did. And it was on these grand strategic grounds. I now think, looking back on it, that it was really an absolute disaster, because I think that 68 was a time when it might have been possible to reform communism in Eastern Europe. I think it would have become some form of capitalism in the end, but it would have happened without all the failings that occurred in the transition after 1990, which caused enormous suffering. I think it would have been much smoother, it would have been very popular, the countries would have been much more egalitarian and emerged out of it, and I think Europe would have been very different. So I think historically it was a terrible disaster. At the time, I had this simple view, it's them or us, and them in this sense was the right and the left was us, right? And we were represented by the Soviet Union. Now, I look back on that and say that I did say that, and I knew about it. It was Soviet tanks were destroying Czech democracy. It's just that I thought they were great power and interests that were more important. I now think that was a very serious mistake on my part. Whether it is a moral mistake or a mistake of analysis, I'm not sure. I mean, in those kind of situations, it's not easy to decide which kind of mistake it is. But I would certainly say that was really wrong.
I mean, you're a bigger man than certain unnamed individuals who we better not dwell on too much. Sounds in some ways as if you're likely to have a lot of sympathy and admiration for George Orwell, are you?
I am, but...
But?
If you look at the history of Spain, the people he liked were probably the people who were most responsible for the outbreak of the Civil War, because the same people he admired were the people that were going around...
You mean the Spanish?
Spanish Civil War, yeah. Killing priests, burning down... Yeah. Nunneries, churches, monasteries, things like this. I mean, so the anarchists. I mean, the reason the communists got so much support in Spain was not actually because they. I don't think it's because they were supported by the Soviet Union. I think it's they were the only force for order and moderation. I mean, the communists are always a strange group because they can be more ruthless than other people because they can decide it's necessary. So it's a communist, as far as I can tell, who organised the massacre in Paracuellos, possibly. It's unclear when they killed thousands because they thought it was necessary. It's like in the Katyn massacre when Stalin killed Poles. On the other hand, they also believe in alliances and discipline. So if they think in order to win the war they have to ally with the middle class, etc., they will do so. And they will swallow their pride, or whatever it is, and they will just form an alliance, and they produce order and discipline. Whereas the anarchists and the Trotskyists that Orwell liked don't have that degree of discipline. But they may not be as ruthless.
This is where you disagree with him on his homage to Catalonia stuff.
Yes.
That period, but the fact that he started off very sympathetic in that way, but his later. Not recantation, but reorientation through his life and his later novels and so on, which show the dangers of totalitarian systems and so on so well. You presumably like.
Yes, well, I think 1984 is an excellent book like this, because I think more than Animal Farm, I think. 1980, because Animal Farm is really about communists, I think. 1984 is very good because my son, who read it when he was, I think, just finishing off at sixth form in school, really brought to me, he said the thing which had most effect on him was Newspeak, which was a language which was unusual for languages because its vocabulary was always diminishing. And the thing is that this way of thinking, which is a kind of communist way of thinking, well, Stalin is what you might call it, but that's a bit of a kind of Stalin. It's a bit wider in comments than Stalin. It is actually true of social democracy. I mean, we have the same thing today in a more limited way with the Labour Party, for example, that some things are not sayable, some things are not thinkable. I think this, you see it in amongst American liberals and so on, which is very hostile to the notion of free speech and free discussion. The notion that enlightened people can determine what the parameters of debate are. And enlightened people is always, of course, us.
Yes.
So, I mean, I've got terribly disillusioned with the whole concept of enlightenment, because it contains within the notion that individuals somehow have a privileged view of the world. I mean, it's always used as a term to support those who believe a particular thing. They're enlightened and the others are not.
What I would like to just return to talk for the end bit is for you to talk a little bit more about your own work. I mean, you've worked on labour organisation, equality, industrialisation, you've been an advisor to many government bodies and so on. If you had to sort of select out what you think has been your major theoretical or methodological contributions in economics, what would you...
Yes. Well, things I've worked on almost everything in economics, being a bit of a dilettante by nature, but it's also because I've just worked for a very long time. And I get bored with the same thing, doing the same thing forever. I would say one of the best pieces I did was in 1977, following the first oil shock, which was a theoretical analysis of the inflationary process. And essentially it's argued that the consequences of things like the oil shock, for example, would eventually lead to cause unemployment. It would provoke an economic crisis where it ended up in unemployment. I think that was a good article. It was intellectually the forerunner of what became in Europe the dominant way of thinking about inflation for a very long time.
It happened to be true. I mean, your predictions came down.
Yes, I think it was. Yes, I mean, I think the first for quite widely accepted reasons. I think that I would regard that was one of my best pieces. A second, I think the stuff I did on the decline of manufacturing industry, deindustrialization, because that was a very early work saying it was an inevitable feature of advanced economies. At the time, people weren't saying that.
But you seem to have changed your mind, because the account I've read of it, a very brief account, suggested that you thought that not only was it inevitable, but probably welcome at first, to a certain extent, but now you believe that we've gone too far and that we've deindustrialised too far.
Yes, I do. Yes, exactly right. It's a bit like saying somebody's overweight, they've got to have a diet, and the next thing they look anorexic. that's absolutely right. I mean, I think that is the rule. We overshot by much too much. Yes, that's right. So now I'd be associated with somebody who thinks we need a bigger manufacturing sector, and then these people say, oh, that's just old-fashioned, why do you believe that, and you should move with the times. Then I have to point out to them I wrote the first major work on the opposite side. Those are two. Now, the interesting question is, why did I think the decline of manufacturing was important? Because many economists say, who cares about these things? Well, I think it was partly to do with economics, but it was partly because I come from a steel town, steel and docks, and for me, I mean, I was brought up in the industrial world, and for me, a proper job was an industrial job. It was the great transformation of the society was interesting to me. So it wasn't simply to do with the economics of it. It was to do with the fact there was a big social transformation going on. But I think I underestimated enormously how hard it would be to move to an alternative service economy which would generate decent jobs for people. Because one of the characteristics of most service economies is they're more inegalitarian than industrial economies. The middle is small.
The working class disappears to a certain extent.
Yes, well, I think that's one of the great losses. I mean, in fact, I think one of the biggest problems of democracy now in Western countries is the decline of an organised working class, because I think an organised class based around trade unions and historically industry and manufacturing, but is the basis for effective Labour parties, and it's a basis for effective political administration. And I think the societies we have now, but they no longer have any external organised organisations which support them significantly. Anyway, those are two. What else are there? Well, I think those are probably two of the most important. In recent times, I've got interested in other topics, really.
Hmm.
I mean, I got very interested in the family disintegration and the decline of families, so I did a book on law and economics of family life, basically. I did it with other people.
Tell me what the argument of that book was.
Well, I think the disintegration of stable families, and if you look in Western societies, it varies a lot from society to society. But Northern Europe, for example, Northwestern Europe, particularly in America, Anglophone countries, have had an enormous degree of family instability, extramarital childbearing, collapse of marriage, etc., etc. This whole complex of things. I think it's a disaster. I don't think it's some kind of people seeking wonderful new forms, ways of living, experiments. I think it's a social crisis which should be called as such. And the causes of it are quite complex, I think. But there's an intellectual basis to it. And the intellectual basis is hedonism, the notion which is the decline of the fact that people can enter into binding arrangements between each other which they're expected to keep. Decline of the notion of promise and so on. Now, the old left, of course, was quotes conservative on these issues. I mean, there was always a radical quotes which was called Bohemian Fringe.
Mm.
But in my time in the Communist Party, you can't imagine anybody more conservative over these things than working class communists.
Mm.
And this would be true of men and women, so it wasn't just men. And I think that's been a really big disintegration. So I think in working class life, particularly because there's been much more disintegration. The lower you go down in the social scale, the more disintegration there is. It's not, as it were, simply a class-free phenomenon. The combination of disintegrated institutions, like trade unions, and fragmentation of family life, I think is responsible for the big social disorders in degree of social disorder. I don't mean just, when I mean social disorder, I mean fragmentation. I don't mean simply. Rioting in the streets. And I think that's a very, very big crisis. And I think economic issues in advanced countries are declining in importance. I mean, obviously people are now complaining about the cost of living rising and so on, but these are countries which are still by any historical standards extraordinarily prosperous.
Mm.
And whereas I think family disintegration, for example, is a really big and serious issue.
And did you come to the conclusion that changing some of the conditions, like legal structures and so on, could ameliorate the situation?
Yes, I think my feeling is it's essentially, I don't say it's a long road back, because wherever we end up, we won't be back where we were before. I mean, who knows, the disintegration may be the necessary prelude to some well-functioning alternative in the future. You can never tell these things. But it seems to me that public policies had quite a big effect on this, I think. I think in two senses. First of all, in terms of what's approved and not approved of, because public policy has some symbolic as well as a practical effect. But I also think practically, in the welfare state, for example, and the US has quite extensive welfare state in this area, despite what people say about it, underpins family fragmentation, penalises people who stay together. Well, put it another way, if you break up, for example, if you have children without being together, it will subsidise you, essentially. And as an economist, I tend to believe what you pay for is what you get. So that's I got very interested in that.
Mm.
And I was an advisor to the Centre for Social Justice, which is the Tory Party think tank.
Mm.
Well, it's independent, quotes, but it's the Tory Party.
Mm.
On family policy, when they did their report last year. I would have done it for Labour, but
they didn't ask you.
not interested in this.
We've covered only a tiny bit of your life, but are there any sort of major areas you think that I should have asked you about or would have been nice to talk about?
Yes, one area is what I've been working on for the last few years, which is this group at the Santa Fe Institute, is the fact that the economic model that which was dominant for many, many years in academic life was the notion that economies consist essentially of selfish, amoral people.
Hmm.
Now, every economist knows that this is not true, I mean, in the sense that they personally, they're not as much like that. But it's the working hypothesis. And the assumption is that that's basically true. There may be exceptions, but that's the basic way of looking at it. And a number of people became very disillusioned with this. They thought, well, that's clearly not true. I mean, lots of studies of people working in industrial relations, for example, showed that the concepts of fairness were very important in industrial relations, that there's a vast number of examples of generosity which cannot be explained by, at any level as egoistic self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they might be what people thought they ought to do, which is mm-hmm. probably right. And so a number of economists over the years have got interested in the in altruism, for example, or rule-following behaviour, which is conformism, things like this, and have argued that they're very important in economic life. They're not just marginal, they're really important, and that it's a scientific error, as it were, to put them, to dismiss them as just a little bit of noise that we can ignore. The main message doesn't require us to think about them. And biologists have started to talk about this. They talk about through altruism, for example. In fact, there's quite a long history of it, 30 years biologists, and Darwin himself talked about this. So I got drawn into the biologists and biological anthropologists into Robert Foley's one here, into a research group on questions like altruism, social cooperation, social order, things like this. And that I got really interested in that. And I think the project there, I mean, it is a grand project, but it's essentially an attempt to understand the evolution of human beings, why should they be like this. Because economists are a bit like, was it Doubting Thomas? I've got to touch the stigmata, as it were. Mm. Otherwise, I don't believe it. So if they don't have a biological justification for it, they don't believe it's true. But anyway, I got involved in this research project, and I would say that one of the things that informs people in that increasingly is that a well-functioning society, it's not that it doesn't require things like an effective state apparatus or an effective legal system, but that the things that make a civilized society and a well-functioning society are really the way in which people, the kind of social norms that people have, the way they interact with each other, their perceptions of what their moral responsibilities are, and things like this. And so really it's economists and biologists moving into what would really have been sociology and anthropology. And so that's the stuff I'm working on now, really.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. I mean, in some ways it's ironic that the man who started it all, to a certain extent, was quite aware of the double nature of human beings. I mean, The Theory of Moral Sentiments by Adam Smith is a wonderful book, and because it says we are driven by two great passions, self-love and social love, and that both of them, approbation of others through kindness and morality, and the desire to maximize our opportunities, are equally powerful passions in human beings, and they are nearly always balanced. And it may be that the shopkeeper won't sell you things because he's kind, but there are many other aspects of our lives which are ruled by the desire to be loved. And so it started like that, but one side of it was tended to get a bit forgotten in the next couple of hundred years.
Yes, well, I think Adam Smith regarded The Theory of Moral Sentiments as his most important book.
Mm.
I think it wasn't just that it was The Wealth of Nations. I actually think he thought it was more important than The Wealth of Nations. So I think it's a fantastic book.
Mm. I do too.
That, but also Darwin, because Darwin's Descent of Man, The Origin of Species, but The Descent of Man, is full of things about the evolution of altruism, things being good for the group, for example.
Mm.
And in fact, I mean, well, what work have I done personally on this? Well, I've done an article, oddly enough, in the journal Theoretical Biology on population genetics about the evolution of altruism.
Mm.
And also work on group selection models, which is combined genetic and social evolution. And the evolution of human beings genetically is influenced by the cultural environment, but conversely, the cultural environment, the nature of human beings has a genetic component, so the way they learn, for example, has a genetic basis.
Mm.
So, and things like that.
Fascinating.
So there's most areas of economics.
Almost everything from love up and down. Anyway, I think perhaps that might be a time to let you get off to your economics party. So thank you very much indeed, Rob.
Thanks. I have a feeling the interview is a bit like my life, really. A bit disorganised, but after the event probably looks as though it's got more coherence than it actually had.